On this episode of The Playbook, I have the greatest poker player in the world, all-time greatest player, Phil Hamuth, joining me. And he's going to talk about why you cannot be an electron playing poker or in life. Join me for all this positivity and more.
This is Entrepreneurs The Playbook, where each week I bring you some of the greatest athletes, celebrities, and entrepreneurs to talk about their personal and professional playbook to success and what made them champions on the field and in the boardroom. I'm your host and CEO of Sports One Marketing, David Meltzer.
This is Dave Meltzer with Entrepreneurs The Playbook, and I have a different type of entrepreneur. We haven't had one on yet, Phil Hamuth Jr., the world champion poker player, 15 bracelets, one main event back in 89. We're going to have to ask him how much he actually won back then, how much that's worth today. But most importantly, I had to have him on the playbook because he wrote a book. You know when people tell you, hey man, you wrote my book? I bet you tons of people tell you that about this book. Positive.
It's so true. It's so true. But, you know, I mean, it's interesting. For me, as a poker player, you have to look inside because I'm one of the only professions you can lose all of your money on any given day. And the pressure that creates if you get a little too drunk or whatever, you know what I mean? It's the pressure that creates. And as human beings, when we're losing, we tend to, you know, you learn this from the stock market, we press. And in poker, you press. And so there's all those sessions where you play 30 or 40 hours to try to get even because you just can't get away from the table. And legendary, there's just legends of all these poker players losing all their money in one day, 60-hour session. And then they usually fight back. And so I had to be on guard for that. It made me look inside all the time and look for truth. And so, yeah, I'm really proud of this book.
And the subtitle, right? You're at the right place.
You're always in the right place at the right time.
This is what I always say.
Eight life tips. People don't understand this.
Yeah.
You want me to give you a story
please,
about that?
Yeah, I
okay.
love it.
So this is in my book. And
I might steal it for my speech tomorrow. So
you can have it.
Good. Yeah.
So it's very simple. You have a guy who sat down at the dinner table with his wife, and he says, I have the perfect idea for a sports bar. Five perfect reasons why it will work. Shh. This guy says, Martha, please pass the peas. Martha, please pass the peas was given to me by Carl Westcott, who's a famous kind of a billionaire who was a great friend of mine. That means the guy's done with the idea. Let's move him over right next door. The guy's sitting at the dinner table with his wife and kids, lays out the perfect sports bar, five reasons why it's going to work, right? The difference is this guy, the next day after work, all he does is he walks into his favorite sports bar. Once he opens the door to walk in, he's also opened a metaphorical door. Imagine, once that door is open, there's eight more doors behind it. You could tell me what those eight doors are. Anybody listening could tell me what those eight doors are. You know, maybe he buys this guy's bar. Maybe this guy helps him with financing. Maybe there's all these possibilities. But all he's done is walk in and meet the owner of the sports bar. And so, so these guys are both in the right place at the right time. They both have great ideas, but one person has taken the step forward. And too many people out there won't take that first step. So we're always in the right place at the right time. And next.
That is so true. You know, one of the things you were talking about, losing it all. Have you ever seen the movie The Greatest Showman? And I get teased. Hugh Jackman, right? But that one line, you know, when he's going to reinvest, and like, yeah, but you could lose everything, and he just quickly turns and goes, that's how I got here. When I think of entrepreneurs, when I think of poker players, that's how you got there. You can't get there unless you understand that everything comes through you, and they're hyper-competitive, entrepreneurs and poker players, but everything comes through you, Phil. You cannot have a scarce value or any fear. So how do you take control of your ego, which gives you that need to be afraid?
I mean,
the ego's never more present than in poker.
For me, that's a very difficult question. But luckily, I've been married to my wife for 29 years, who happens to be super high EQ and IQ, kind of a genius. A doctor at Stanford, a psychiatrist, and so for her, she's been able to help me a little bit, especially through couples therapy, right?
Yeah.
Because when you have a big ego, it's not good for a marriage.
Right.
You know what I'm talking about?
I do. Honey, you're watching. She knows. We won't let them in the room to tell the truth, but yes.
Yeah, and so, you know, I think of the primary relationship as being, like, imagine two fists together, and you just keep working on it and working on it, and it's, you're in a an environment where you can both speak up and be listened to. Normally, if the average person goes home to their wife and says, you're doing this poorly, they're going to be, F you, you're worse at this than I am. You never get anywhere. But when you're in therapy, she'll come up to me and say, I think this is true about you. Now, 90% of the time, I'll say, I think you're right, and I'll take a look at it. Occasionally, I might refute it, but in a without an F you, you know, in a very comfortable,
way.
Yeah, in a very, with a therapist there, I don't think this is the case because of this. But, you know, so my wife keeps bringing me things, and I just keep searching deep to improve and get better and better. And what happens as your primary relationship gets better, every other relationship gets better. The first concrete evidence I had of this was maybe in 04. I was driving along with a friend, and I was listening to him, and he started crying. He was 72 years old. John Benetti starts crying in the car. And he's like, it's the first time you've really listened to me. And I just smiled and thought, wow, that's all the work my wife and I are doing, now extending to my best friends.
That is awesome. In the book itself, right, 8 tips, I always like to say, what's, and I mean, just so you know, I mean, the who's who, Tony Robbins, right, Draymond Green, like, the who's who endorsed this book.
And I heard Draymond Green's my boy, so
that's awesome.
I mean, I love him.
Well, Sheryl Sandberg, I mean, this
Sheryl
is
Sandberg gave me an amazing,
yes.
She read it cover to cover and was just like,
70
wow.
minutes, it's for millennials, 70 minutes cover to cover. But what's the number one tip?
I mean, all right, I'll go into this. It's called Hate Hurts You. And, you know, I mean, I came up with this when I was studying Buddhism at Esalen, the spiritual place, you know, on the California coast.
Are
you familiar?
Yeah.
Okay. So I was studying Buddhism with the Lama Suryadas and had all these realizations. And so I kind of came up with my own 3-step system for getting rid of hate. And I think for every person out there, well, I'll take you through the exercise if you're watching this podcast. You at home, imagine you're thinking about, just think about the person you hate the most. Get that person in your mind or dislike the most. Okay, that person's not thinking about you right now and probably hasn't thought about you in days or weeks. You're using negative energy, hating somebody. So I'm telling you at home, forgive not for that person, forgive for yourself. And so it's a 3-step process. So first step process, first part of that process is to think about that person and imagine why they slighted you. Now, in most cases, that doesn't work. There's a good reason you hate them. But sometimes there's a little bit of, you know, solace when you think, well, maybe they did it for this reason. Number two, try to come up with something good about that person.
Find the light in them.
Yes. Do they give money to charity? Are they good to their wife? Are they good to their kids? Find something. And then the third step is kind of a form of meditation where you just, you know, make sure the house is empty. No one's going to bother you for an hour because you don't know how long you're going to be out. And just go to your bed or a nice comfortable place where you're not going to be disturbed. This is key, for an hour. And just kind of close your eyes and start thinking about that person that you hate. And start sending him love. It's the most unnatural thing you've ever done. You're like, what the heck is going on here? It's so hard to do. But you send him love, you send him love, you send him love, you send him love. And then while I'm down, I usually will send all the people that I dislike love or hate. And then I'll also send it to my family and, you know, my parents and my wife and my kids. But whatever. The point is to spend 15, 20 minutes, half an hour, whatever it is. Now, the freaky thing is, when I've done this in the past with 2 people in specific, the next time I saw that person, it's like they had completely changed towards me. And I'm like, this is just weird, it can't be. So if you don't like that explanation of something mystic happening, there's a very scientific explanation that when I saw that person, I actually didn't have hate in my eyes and I didn't attack them immediately, right? And so because of that, maybe I had something else in my life, in my eyes, like tolerance. And maybe they picked up on that signal. That's the science
peace
behind
or
this.
Love, right?
Correct. They picked up on that, and their attitude complaint, you know, changed towards me completely.
Love has no defense. Love has no defense, right? Now, Sue, I have a question to ask you. You know, I do a lot of coaching with athletes, and every once in a while I get a professional poker player, And I want to get your opinion on something that I teach that's completely aligned with this Buddhist philosophy. So I got it in with golf. I used to tell golfers, don't do this when you're in a foursome, right? Because there's the same kind of gambling that goes on in golf. Don't sit there and think that you can say, miss it, miss it, miss it, and then pick your club up and think that just because you want to make it, you haven't, your energy hasn't shifted. In order to increase your chance, what you should be saying is make it, make it, make it, because I have a limited effect with my prayer on them to make it, but I have 100% effect on myself. And if I'm in tune with make it, make it, make it, make it, statistically, mathematically, I'm gonna make it. Same thing holds true. Don't tell them not to get their card. Like, I believe that you should be telling them, oh, I hope he gets it, I hope he gets it, I hope he gets it. Because you have so little effect on whether he really gets it or not, but what you're doing is drawing in and harnessing the energy that when you draw your card, or obviously when they turn it, it's your card. And it's an amazing effect. Do you see any significance or mathematical validation of what I'm saying, or would you use something like that?
I actually love that. I would use something like that. I even thought about, wow, when I've been golfing, I usually don't root against, I haven't had good luck rooting against people when I'm golfing for high stakes.
Yeah.
I just let them do their thing. If they make the putt, great. If they don't make the putt, great. But I'm just trying to focus on what I'm doing.
Yeah.
You know, and that's make my putt. And so I like that. That's good. I don't know. I have to think about whether I want to go as far as rooting
poker
for them.
Yeah.
Sometimes I think, you know, whether it's illusion or delusion.
Right.
Delusional. Sometimes I think that I have a lot more power than we understand. And so it seems like when I'm charging forward with positivity that, you know, great things can happen to me quickly. So maybe there's something to that. Maybe
give it some,
I don't really root against other people in big pots.
I say take it to the next level.
I learned
level.
A long time.
I say take it to the next level.
Root for
them.
My opponent.
And for yourself. It'll add. I think it adds exponential value to the power of
That's
positivity.
I'm going to think about that. Thank
Please
you.
Please do. And let me know what happens. Let me know what happens. You've won over $23 million. How much was your first main event, the 89? How much did you win?
That was $750,000.
Which back then was, people were taught, I'm old enough to know, right? They're like, how the heck are they paying, right, on ESPN? How are they spending this much money? He won $750,000.
That's like $10 million today or something.
Yeah, I mean, ridiculous. I have a question, though, because most people don't ask this of gamblers. How much money have you lost?
Ooh.
Right? It's nowhere to be found on Wikipedia anywhere. It's like $23 million, but how much
sure.
money have you lost?
No, I mean, I don't know the exact number, but I mean, you know, I pay a lot of, I know this, when it comes to ROI in poker,
yeah.
USA Today did a study about 8 years ago now, and the chart's like this, and I was a little speck way up here. Part of that is just being conservative and not playing as many tournaments as the other guys. Part of that is that I've crushed a lot of the smaller ones, like $1,500 buy-ins, $3,000 mm-hmm. buy-ins, $5,000 buy-ins. And so return on investment's tricky, but I've always kind of prided myself. And you know, let me tell you, back in the day, I decided I want to be the greatest poker player of all time. I decided that a long time ago. And in going for that goal, I was also perfectly aligned with paying the bills for my wife and kids. And so, you know, inspiration and desperation, right?
Right.
So desperation was my friend for a long time in order to drive me. I mean, I would be at a final table and I'd be like, we have like $7,000 or $8,000 left in the bank. Now I have a beautiful house and cars, but man, I need to pay the bills. And I'd be like, all right, how much is first, second, third?
Right,
I better make the top three because
you're manifesting it.
Back then, if you make the top three players, then you'd almost always make a deal because it was so tilted. It'd be 400, 200, and 100. It was always like, you know, four times as much for first,
right.
Twice as much as second, 400, 200, 100. And I'm like, I gotta make it to the final three because, you know, fourth place was always like 60.
Right.
You know?
Fifth place, your first time was like 15, probably.
It was way down. And so you really had to make the top three. I was really good at making the top three. And so, I mean, part of that is trying to provide for my family. The desperation of making sure that you could pay the bills helped me achieve my goals.
What skills, you know, characteristics or skills do you think are most suited for playing poker?
I think you have to have a conservative nature because you have two things in poker. Money management trumps everything. So, I mean, I've seen people that have money management here and poker skills up here. They don't have good lives.
That's awesome.
They lose everything.
Right. It's just like entrepreneurs. I've seen the same thing. Tremendous skills, but they can't stay in business.
Yes.
Right? And yes. The number one rule in business is to stay in business.
Stay in business.
I don't care how talented you are.
So you want to have a great money management. So that has to be like near the probably the top of the list. And then great skills behind that. But part of the money management is not to lose too much money in one day, not to risk too much money in a week or a month, and make sure you're playing at the right level for whatever your bankroll is. I've been always very conservative, and that's led to good wealth for me, right? And I'm very... but the skills, to come to the skills and turn this into a two-part question.
Good.
I apologize.
That's good.
reading ability. Reading ability trumps all.
Is that awareness, intuitiveness? What's a reading ability?
Both.
Okay.
It's like seeing everything at the table, you know, seeing this guy's, you know, someone over here has to act, and you see this guy start to sit up in his chair. He's getting excited, and you're like, wow, he has a big hand, right? And then over the years saying, and then when he does make his move saying, I think he has jacks, or tens or nines, or I think he has aces, kings, or queens. Most people have no idea.
Right.
But you have to like distinguish it to a range of these three hands. The number of times I've called somebody's hand out loud and said, you have tens, it freaks people out. Now that's lucky because I felt like it was nines, tens, or jacks.
Yeah, yeah.
But when you can start doing that, then you could almost become unbeatable in poker. Why? If you could see everybody's whole cards every hand, you would win every tournament.
Correct.
So then if you can start peering into that person and understanding if they're weak or strong, you can use that information. So many tournaments I've won because someone over there raises and I know they have nothing. And I have nothing. Mm-hmm. So most people would just fold me, I just re-raise. And if you can do that 10 times a day, you're accumulating all these chips. You know, you're kind of building a house brick by brick. And in extreme versions, sometimes I'll get away with, you know, raising 30 or 40 times per tournament with nothing. That's really hard because you're really living on the edge.
Yeah, you know?
Your reads have to be perfect. And if you're wrong a couple of times, you're losing big chunks of chips. So reading ability trumps all. And then, you know, some of these mathematical theories they're coming up with are pretty cool. I like the way they're looking at Hold'em. I like the way they're breaking it down. A lot of times they're wrong, though. So it's interesting. So they sometimes think I'm delusional, and sometimes I think they're delusional. And I think that that's healthy because a lot of styles can win in poker. But I'm pretty sure I'm going to say I'm not delusional, damn it.
Now, you named all those different things and movements, but one of the things I believe in the energetic world and your Buddhist beliefs is, do you ever feel something? Like without the guy moving up or, you know, an elevated heartbeat, blinking, or, you know, all these different indicators that I've heard from poker players help tip them off what the guy's doing. But I've watched a lot of poker and I've trying to connect to or channel through what the feeling is. And sometimes I'm like, that guy just knows. He feels it. Do you ever have that?
All the time. I mean, when you're watching on television, when I'm watching the monitors of a live poker tournament and they go close to the guy's face, I'm like, he's weak, he's strong, he's weak. And sometimes there'll be, you know, 20, 30 people gathered around as I'm saying it, and I'm right every time, and they show the cards, weak, strong, weak, strong, weak, strong. That's when at my peak, and that's a great place to be. I'm not, unfortunately, not always there, and I probably need to train a little bit harder. But sometimes you pick things up, I don't understand why. It might be a movement, it might be the way they, it might just be more than that. But you have to be open to accept all of that data, wherever it comes from,
including
whatever
what that card is. Do you ever get a feeling just, man, it doesn't make any sense, but that's my card?
I try not to tap into that too much because sometimes I'm wrong. I mean, I had
a
really strong feeling that I'm gonna win a hand.
Yeah.
And then sometimes that doesn't happen, whereas the dependable is reading people. That's more dependable.
Right, because there's variance, and I always tell people, we misread things. You can get that feeling, but it may be about something else.
It's true.
It's like those mind readers or the people that will tell you, they'll do the thing, and I'll say, no, you're not, like when I do body scans and other things that I've learned from quantum healing, and the one rule is don't analyze. Because the minute you start analyzing, then you're off. All right, last question. With Positivity is your great new book. It's going to sell millions of copies. You can reach out to me, I'll give you one as well. So I'm gonna be a big customer. This is my type of book. But Phil, you know, it's different because, you know, just like anything else, everything has evolved. Your brand has evolved. The sport has evolved. What legacy, when it's all said and done, would you like to leave as one of the world's greatest?
Well, first, let me say it's interesting. I'm joining all these advisory boards, and I joined Lasso.
Yeah.
Lasso.
Thank you.
Healthwear.
Champ Bailey, Hall of Fame. My
Lasso
man.
Is kind of like, it's amazing. They have these amazing socks that James, compression socks that James Harden wears. James Harden's not being paid to wear these. Yeah. And there's like a 75% less chance your ankle's going to roll. And so I love this. I joined the advisory board. And that's kind of fun for me to have businesses going on to join advisory boards. But my legacy is going to be, you know, either I'm going to be known for 100 years. No one's known 100 years. But if I were, I'd want to be known for starting the positivity movement and just showing the world these 8 things will help all of you think better and create more. But also, what I've been trying to do until I wrote this book is I want to be known as the greatest poker player of all time. And I have all those records. So I'm kind of going for both.
Nice.
I'm taking my own advice in this book, and I'm reaching big.
That's it. Be kind to your future self. Know that you're always in the right place at the right time. I say the perfect place at the right time. You have the world's greatest poker player with Dave Meltzer, Phil Hamut Jr., here with Entrepreneurs, The Playbook. Well, I hope you enjoyed this week's episode of The Playbook as much as me. On a personal note, I just wanted to thank everyone for making The Playbook such a success. Don't forget to continue it by sharing, subscribing, and listening to your favorite episodes. This is Dave Meltzer with The Playbook.